Throughout the 1970s, the TLA Cinema on South and 4th Streets has shown repertory and cult films ranging from American musical comedies to French New Wave cinema to the Rocky Horror Show. A few months ago, it looked pretty certain that the theater was going to close. Because Stephen Starr, the owner of Starr's, the club on 2nd and Bainbridge, had eyes to use the buy the theater and convert it into a nightclub, when we initially asked Al Malmfeldt, director of the TLA, to speak with us on Fresh Air today, we were thinking that this would be somewhere between a retrospective and a eulogy for the TLA. But now the closing of the TLA is less imminent. You probably know that members of the South Street community have been trying to prevent the demise of the TLA by petitioning against granting a liquor license for the proposed club, and also objecting to the noise that a club might create. There's currently a legal battle also pending between the TLA and the owners of the property. But right now, the TLA is open, and there's no definite plans for its closing. Al Malmfeldt, the director of the TLA Cinema, is my guest. Al, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. It's nice to be back on Fresh Air.
Before we talk a little bit about how you've approached finding movies for the theater and how the theater has changed, how South Street has changed, because you've been there for all of the South Street Renaissance, what's the current status of the theater? If you could just give us an update on that.
Well, in a word, the current situation is uncertain. It's not nearly as pessimistic as a lot of people believe. There was a considerable amount of publicity a month or so ago, which is entirely the result of press releases sent out by Stephen Starr, all of which were, the contents purported of which were printed in the newspapers without being verified. And many people believed what he said, that he was going to be in possession a month ago and renovating and having his first acts on stage this week, I believe. And he has been prevented in court from closing his agreement of sale. We're in a very complex legal struggle with the owners of the property, and we think we have a shot at staying. We have a program out right now that runs October and November, and we're planning another one, which will begin booking next week, to run beyond that.
Obviously, you don't want to see the theater closed.
Oh, no, I want to stay.
Okay. How did you start the TLAL?
Well, I started it... Actually, I was working for someone else at the time in New York, running a very small circuit of repertory cinemas there. And I first came to TLA to convert it from what had been a legitimate theater. It was been closed for about a year before I first saw it. And came to convert it into a cinema and do the publicity on the first repertory program that we did. And it was a satellite for its first 4 months or so, 4 to 6 months. And that was very unsuccessful.
A satellite of what, this New York house?
A satellite of the New York operation. There were three houses up in New York. And it was believed by the person for whom I was working originally, who subsequently became my partner, and eventually I bought him out. But anyway, he believed that it could all be done long distance. That successful films that were shown up there could be simply moved down here, and we could run TLA by mail and telephone. It was a fallacious theory, and about 6 months later, I put my first program on the screen, and things began to turn around. One of the things about repertory cinema that's different from conventional movie theater chain is that in the conventional situation, you put films on the screen and take them off, and they're usually current films, and if it's a hit, people go to see the film. They don't care what theater they're seeing it in. And if it's not a hit, people don't go to see it, and they don't care what theater is playing it. In the case of repertory cinema, because of the sheer volume of films that we show, the fact that some of them are fairly new and some of them are quite old, there's an awful lot of give and take between the cinema and its public. And the patrons have the opportunity to get a message across with regard to the kind of films that they want to see, the individual films they want to see, and the films that they don't want to see. And because of that sort of give and take, it was necessary that there be somebody here on premises, a resident director, taking the public pulse, getting to know the people who are coming to the theater, getting to know their tastes.
Because that shows that there's regional differences between what people want to see.
Oh, significant, yes.
What was South Street like when the TLA became a cinema in 1971?
South Street was very quiet. which would come as a surprise, I suppose, to many people who frequent South Street today. You could park a car anywhere on any block of South Street at any time of day or night. You would never run into a crowd. As a matter of fact, at night, the street was almost invariably deserted. And that was that was the situation that we found. There were already some craft shops and galleries, there's a neighborhood coffee house. There's some very small places open to the public by people who could truly be called pioneers, who had come to a street that was under the axe in a way. South Street was slated to be demolished for Crosstown Expressway. That plan had been on the city books for about 10 years, and landlords had not improved their properties. The values had deteriorated, and a lot of people came in to an area where they a commercial area where they could deal with the public because they could afford the numbers, and they stayed and they struggled. Some left, some were replaced. But they determined the original flavor of the street. And there were about half full. I think there were about five people who are still operating in the community who were there before I arrived in 1971. And it was definitely an odd mix between old-fashioned businesses. I don't mean that in the pejorative sense. Dry goods places and so on.
Bridal shops.
Lots of bridal shops, yes. And alternative culture shops.
It's funny because it still is that mix of that. There's still dry goods places and bridal shops, less so, but they're still there.
Yeah, I think the gap is being bridged as the street has become more successful, has become more commercial, more desirable place for people to go and do business. And so the distinction is not as sharp as it once was.
Did you foresee what was going to happen on South Street in terms of the economic boom, the Renaissance?
I foresaw that there would be a substantial development in the street. I certainly did not foresee what occurred. If anyone had said to me in 1971 that 7 or 8 years down the road, that very quiet street would be the busiest thoroughfare in Philadelphia during non-business hours, I would have doubted the person's sanity. But it's happened. There are more people on South Street, weekday evenings, all day Saturdays and Sundays and holidays, than any other part of the city.
How has that affected you? Has it made it easier or harder to operate? Because usually the more successful an area like that becomes, the more expensive it is to operate from it. Though, on the other hand, the more people show up. So I guess it has its pros and cons.
Yeah, it does have its pros and cons. It has brought a lot more people who become aware of the theater and who get our programs and having a lot of street traffic back and forth, thousands of people every day who can pick up a program, see what we're going to be showing is helpful. On the other hand, yes, it has become a boom town, and I think if it hadn't, that the current legal struggle that we're in would not exist. But you know, you take the good with the bad, and no matter what you do.
The early 70s was a great time for the revival of theaters, like the TLA. Movie theaters were becoming rock theaters, and just almost community places for a interesting mix of events and films. What was the atmosphere like working in TLA at the time? The spirit amongst the people who worked there, the spirit amongst the people who came, has it changed much?
Oh yeah, it's changed. It's changed quite a lot. In the early days, things were kind of funky. The bulk of our staff came from a community. Many of the people in that community 9 years ago could be described as dropouts. People who just didn't want to hack it in a commercial world. Remember, it's still, you know, just still post 1968. A lot of people had gone through changes around that time, and a lot of the early customers that we got were very sympathetic with that sort of social attitude. And things have changed. The times have changed. people are not as funky as they were a decade ago. South Street itself has become more commercial. There are more tourists. The big visible difference on South Street is that there are more people coming there now because it has become a scene. Whereas in the early 70s, the people who went there to make the scene. And that was what dominated.
What's some of the fun parts and some of the harrowing parts for you of running a theater like the TLA?
Oh, well, the fun parts are devising programs, deciding what to show, what series of festivals to show, coming up with new programming ideas, new program formats, that sort of thing. The harrowing things are when the programs come back late from the printer, or when we have the whole thing laid out and a film distributor will call up at the last minute and cancel a number of bookings, and we have to tear it up and redo part of it, and not knowing. One of the harrowing things, of course, is the uncertainty, taking a chance on a particular program, on a particular festival, and not knowing whether it's going to be successful or not successful, because whenever we do anything at all ambitious, it involves a disproportionate amount of work and effort. We almost never expect to get a proportionate financial reward for doing something like that. It's done because it's interesting, because it makes the theater more interesting for us as well as for the public. And when things like that don't come through, it's kind of frustrating.
Frequently when you have a new schedule coming out, there's a few thematic aspects of the schedule, like a week of a certain French director or of a whole group of French directors or of films about war, films about a certain subject. How do you know what films you're going to have access to? Is there how do you know what's available? I imagine not everything's available every month.
No, it isn't. There are a lot of changes. The situation is somewhat more stable than it used to be because one of the things that's happened throughout the 70s is that repertory cinemas have spread across the country. And the major distributors, the people who control the bulk of the films that are available to theaters around the United States, have become attuned to repertory cinemas as a market. They know they can make money. Consequently, they take the trouble to keep prints of films in service. It used to be that the majors would periodically junk their prints, almost all of their prints, of a fairly recent release, unless it was a blockbuster, and take one or two archive prints and store them in Los Angeles, at studio headquarters. That doesn't happen so much anymore. And as a result of booking over the years, I have a pretty good working knowledge of what's available and what's not most of the time. I unfortunately run across surprises here and there. Plan a whole series, around one or two key films and find out that the key films are going to be missing. And then it means scrapping a series or trying to redo it in some acceptable fashion.
When you're working with old films, you're not assured of getting a good print, though I'll tell you from going to new movies, I think you're not assured in a new cinema of getting a good print either, but it's more risky when you're dealing with old films.
No, ironically it isn't. Newer films that have been released since automation became standard in the motion picture
industry. Projection automation.
Projection automation, yes. TLA, by the way, does not have automated equipment. And I brag about it. Automated equipment is notoriously bad on prints, physically bad. I don't know why it should be the case. You would think that the automated equipment could be designed to be very, very soft and gentle on the equipment. And I don't want to point fingers at whether it's people operated or whether it's the way it's designed or the way the films get inspected. But my experience has been that since automated equipment, the quality of fairly recent releases has fallen off dramatically. And it's very difficult to explain to a patron that a film that was released 2 or 3 years ago has whole scenes missing, chunks of dialogue cut right out, scratches all over it, mucked up soundtrack, and that it's not our fault, that that's not the way we're projecting it, that it's not carelessness on our part, but that it's the condition of the print. I've seen it happen to new films. I've seen films be projected a couple of weeks and be destroyed. Whereas at TLA, we use the kind of equipment that's been around for a lot of years and is very reliable if you maintain the equipment and if you have people handling it who care about what they're doing. We do have people like that. We have very conscientious projections. We have had the experience of running films for a year, two, three, 4 years, as midnight shows, for example, or running print. For example, back in 1974, I ran King of Hearts at TLA for about 15 or 16 weeks. Same print, shown two, three times a day, 7 days a week, 15 or 16 weeks. I saw another print, fresh from the lab, be sent to two theaters, where it was shown a week at each theater, and come back as a bad print. A print that could not be run respectably in front of the public.
What does the distributor do when a print gets too mucky to be played anymore? Will they replace it?
No, they usually throw it away.
The
distributor will not replace a print unless the producer of the film authorizes its replacement. And very often, since the producers are going to make the bulk of their money, see, that's an expense that comes right off the top. The cost of new prints comes off the first monies received by the distributor. And if the producer is going to take that risk, the producer must know that there's more revenue in that particular film. With the advent of classics divisions by some of the major companies, notably United Artists, Columbia, Warner Brothers, this situation has begun to be corrected. I know a fellow who set up the Columbia Classics division recently, a division for which he fought tooth and nail for years. As a matter of fact, he was working for Columbia New York when I was working in New York a decade ago. And after years of fighting, he finally persuaded the company to set up a new division and persuaded them to strike new prints, which meant that they had to, in turn, to go out and persuade producers, that it was worth investing money in these films and that eventually the reward would be there.
Well, do you have any ability to get your money back or to get anything in exchange if you're given a film that isn't good?
If it is disastrous and we have to give out a lot of refunds and there's a major problem with it, we can make some adjustment. But usually they say, oh, too bad, and they'll either junk the print, or if it's just one reel that's bad, they'll pull that reel and perhaps make up a composite print of a couple of bad ones, you know, and send that out.
Another problem in the industry that a lot of filmmakers and probably distributors are concerned about is the way that many color films have been fading. And I know this is a problem that you're aware of. I think Martin Scorsese is currently on a campaign to try to convince people in film technology to develop color that will keep over a long period of time. Now, as someone who runs a screening house, how does that issue affect you?
Well, surprisingly, it doesn't seem to bother the public as much as you would think. It bothers me a great deal. The difficulty is that Eastman Kodak, a company that has a lock on the market in the United States, and in the world, they have a lock on color film, will invest a great deal of money research into home equipment because it is a reliable and high profit market. But they've done very little in the way of research to preserve the integrity of the color stock. For example, old Technicolor films. If you see an old Technicolor print, something could have been made in 1939, and you can see the print today, or you can see a print struck from the original negative. Beautiful. The color doesn't fade. Rich and lush, and just it's a trip just to watch it. But if you see things that were shot in Eastman color, for example, a lot of the a lot of the early new French New Wave films, films by Truffaut and Godard and Chabrol, that that people loved in the early 60s, if you look at those films now, you've no idea what the original color was. You just can't tell. I get very upset whenever I see that. And it's a discredit to the public. It is part, I think, of the disposable mentality that we've been confronted with in the past 10 or 15 years throughout society. You know, it's better to buy something, use it once or twice and throw it away, than to buy something or make something that will last for a long time. It used to be that that film was made to last. Now it isn't. Whether it's the home market or the theatrical market, the presumption is that people are going to have a short-term interest in it, and then that bothers. So why be concerned about how long the color lasts? And Scorsese's right. I hope he wins. I think that if he can generate enough support, and I know the support is out there, he might force Eastman to get off their cans and do something. They don't like bad publicity.
Maybe the repertory cinema movement, and it is a movement now because most major cities have at least one good repertory house that's constantly bringing back films that have gone out of their first release many years ago. Maybe the interest in repertory cinema will also help convince film distributors and Kodak that there will be a constant market for this stuff, and there's profits yet to be made, and that it's worthwhile to develop a good technology.
Well, you're right, and I don't think it would be very difficult to convince the producers or the distributors. They'd all be delighted. You have to go back to the producers. The distributors are going to distribute whatever is there. You know, it's a commodity to them. The producers would love to see the color process that would endure as long as it wouldn't cost them an arm and a leg to create that endurance.
Right. You know, it seems to me that like film and television and music, the record industry, are all discovering that their stuff is recyclable. It can be used. Television is constantly bringing back reruns. There's repertory cinemas. Record companies are doing reissues. That seems to come and go in popularity. A lot of reissue programs seem to have been cut back quite a bit. But there is that interest in keeping documents of the past available and accessible to the public.
Yeah, and you know it's very disturbing. You can go back to a lot of motion picture footage, whether it be feature films or newsreels, whatever, made in the 30s and 40s, largely black and white, even in the 50s. And they are as graphically immediate today as they were when they were shot. And most of them were shot before, you know, we talk about things that were shot before we were born. And yet, films shot in color, which should give us a more real representation of a real world that was shot in our lifetime, don't look anything like the real world because the real world doesn't consist of colors like that.
Right.
And it's really unfortunate.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Al Malmfeldt, the director of the TLA Cinema on South and 4th Streets, and we're talking about the TLA and what it's like to run a repertory cinema. You may have read reports that the TLA was scheduled to have been closed by now and that a club was supposed to have been there in its place, but the closing of TLA is no longer as imminent as it was. There's a new schedule out. The cinema so far is remaining open. Al, you have the cinema has been known not only for its repertory thematic series, but also for its more cult type showings at
sure.
midnight on Fridays
sure.
and Saturdays. And some of the films that I know that have been successful there have been The Harder They Come, Pink Flamingos, and most recently the Rocky Horror Show. Maybe you could compare for us the kinds of audiences that have showed up for those three films and the way they reacted to the screening once in. Certainly the most flamboyant audiences have shown up for the Rocky Horror Show.
First, let me go back to a distinction that we make in doing programming between midnight shows and regular programming. My thesis about programming a cinema for the public has always been within the bounds of reasonable quality to program for as wide a variety of people as possible. We go to the extreme of there's a very cerebral foreign films, to the other extreme of midnight shows that are going to attract essentially a young audience that has absolutely no cerebral interest whatsoever in what they're seeing, at least at that time. Our first midnight show actually was in 1971. We opened the theater. We started with midnight shows right away, and at that time we were showing Night of the Living Dead. We helped to establish midnight shows in Philadelphia. I believe TLA was the first theater in Philadelphia to run midnight shows on a regular basis. And we helped to establish Night of the Living Dead as a cult film in Philadelphia. It, as a matter of fact, it subsequently became a big drive-in item after we had run it quite a lot as a midnight show. But our big successes began with Pink Flamingos in 1973. We ran that for 2 years. And then we had The Harder They Come for a year, and it was in 1976 we began showing Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is still there. If I were to characterize the differences between the basic differences between the audiences of those three films, I would say that Pink Flamingos, because of its subject matter.
Which is what? You should tell us
about
the film.
Its subject matter is about different people who are struggling for the claim of the filthiest person in the world. The film is an intentional gross out. And as it ran on and word about it spread, people would come down who wanted to be grossed out. Well, people who want to be grossed out tend themselves to be rather gross before they arrive. And this was an experience we'd never had at TLA before. And we would, we would find lots of fraternity jocks coming down with six packs of beer, having already evidently consumed quite a lot of beer and grass or whatever by the time they arrived at the TLA, and doing minor acts of vandalism to show that they were as gross as the characters and so on. And that became a bit of a drag. As a matter of fact, we stopped showing the film, not because it was unsuccessful. It really held a pretty steady level for about 2 years, but because we were really sick and tired of the kind of behavior that we were being confronted with. And when we showed The Harder They Come, we had a much more serious midnight audience. It wasn't quite as large as the one for Pink Flamingos, but there were a lot of people who were into the music. And they really just wanted to get off on the movie.
The music is reggae music.
Music was reggae music, and people enjoy the music, enjoy the film, enjoy coming to the theater, and we enjoy that. We didn't have any problems. Pink Flamingos is a case totally apart from anything else. It's really unprecedented in film history because of the phenomenon of audience participation.
You mean the Rocky Horror Show?
I'm sorry, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, yes. And that was something that no one ever anticipated happening. It hadn't happened when it was a stage hit in London for many years. It was a surprise to Richard O'Brien, who was the creator of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I remember having a chat with him a couple of years ago about the way the audiences reacted, and he was really questioning. He said, "They really do that? They really say those things?" I said, "Oh, yes, yes." And it became, in a way, a kind of tourist attraction, because a lot of people would come, a lot of older people would come, to watch the performance of the people who were in the theater, throwing rice and yelling back and forth at the screen.
There was a stage show for quite a while before the movie started.
That's right. That's right. In the first year, year and a half that we had it, we had a coterie of regular performers who would act out different roles in the film. And they've since passed on to other things and from time to time been replaced by a different succession of performers. But there has been established a real Rocky Horror Picture Cult. It's nationwide. There's an organization. They have a publication. They have an annual convention. It goes on and on. And there's been a tremendous amount of energy and quite a few surprises and just a totally different situation with Rocky Horror. For one thing, we for the first time had a midnight show that was, once we established it, was consistently selling out for a very long time. And the situation was a little bit different in Philadelphia from what it was around the country. Philadelphia was one of the test markets for Rocky Horror when it was first released. There were several cities in the country in which it was simply opened as a new film in a downtown theater. It did very badly here, as it did in all the cities that it played in. And I had to fight with the distributor for months to get the film. And then had to fight for another 6 months to keep it, even though the grosses weren't what they had hoped. In the cities in which it had gone, it had opened as a midnight attraction, I think, only in New York and in Austin, Texas, for some reason, before we had it. And then it opened in several other cities. But in the cities where it had never shown as a regular attraction, had never been subjected to reviews, and the only word of mouth was the word of mouth of the people who were getting into the cult right away, it was doing much better than it was in Philadelphia. But after about 6 months of struggling and working out different promotional campaigns and assuring the distributor, wait, be patient, it's going to happen, within a month, it just exploded. And stayed that way for several years.
How did the audience interaction with the film evolve? I've always wondered if people say the same thing to the screen in every city. Have you traveled around, seen it in other cities?
I have not traveled around to that many cities, though I've read about it in other cities. I have seen it in New York. A great deal of the responses were New York originated. And people who had seen it in New York would start doing the same thing in Philadelphia. And then other people would pick up on it. And then they would invent some lines, and they would do certain things. They'd hear about rituals that were going on in other places, and they'd begin those rituals. And it began slowly feeding on itself. Now, there's some variation on the line. Sometimes someone will improvise. But it began piecemeal developing. And it took about a year before the piecemeal development settled into a ritual that you could predict from beginning to end of the film.
The night I saw it, the people who were acting outside of that ritual, who were just yelling what came into their head up at the screen, were booed by everybody
yes,
else.
Yeah,
You're
no.
not supposed to do that.
No. Supposed to go along with the program.
Was there any unusual behavior that you had to, or that whoever had to control during the screenings? Any rowdiness or
occasionally. I mean, you simply can't get
excessive spilling of liquids or whatever.
You simply can't get 400 exuberant people into a public place without having a few crowd control problems. But that happens not just with Rocky Horror Picture Show. That happens with many things, and we're used to it. We had to take pains to begin screening people and stopping certain things from being brought into the theater, and running people through sort of a drill before they got inside the auditorium, so that the staff would be in control of what was going on rather than the audience. But that was just something to work out.
Mm-hmm. You want to keep a rapport with your audience, but also keep things cool.
Yeah. You can't. I mean, you can't either let people come in and take over a theater, or treat customers like cattle and give them a real hard time and push them around and be offensive and take their presence for granted. Some sort of median has to be found. There has to be a firm hand in the velvet glove, if you can pull it off.
You still showing Rocky Horror?
Oh yes.
How has the audience changed?
Well, as time has gone on, the initial sense of adventure and discovery, of course, passed. The audience participation has settled into a ritual, into a real pattern. Generations of performers have come and gone. And it has become, it's become a thing. It's almost an institution. It's not just another movie that's showing. It is, I mean, I don't want to equate it, let's say, with the Fantastics, you know, but it is something that has become obligatory to go and see, for the film and for the audience.
Let's talk a little bit about other types of thematic screenings that you have. I get the feeling sometimes that directors pass in and out of favor with audiences. Take someone like Godard, who will, I'm sure, always be recognized as a great director, but recently a lot of people are talking about Godard, whereas 4 or 5 years ago he seemed to be a little bit on the outs as far as a well-known, highly thought-of director.
Well, in the case of Godard, it's because he really dropped out. He dropped out politically and socially and cinematically. He was doing a lot of television stuff. He has a studio that he does a lot of his work, a lot of his experimental work in Grenoble. And he was not making feature films for the commercial theatrical market. And, you know, out of sight, out of mind.
So
because now he has a new film out, and everybody's right. paying attention to him. It was at the New York Film Festival last week. Vincent Canby wrote a rave review of it. He's been the subject of feature articles in major newspapers in different cities in the country. And now he's getting a lot of attention. He's being rediscovered.
What can you tell us about Philadelphia tastes in terms of which countries or which directors seem to catch on in the city?
In the main, I would say it's the bigger names. There is not as much adventurous exploration of cinematic territory in Philadelphia as there is in a few other cities in the country. Philadelphia, you must remember, is not what you would call an international city, the way that New York is an international city, or Boston, or Washington, or San Francisco. And having an international population in a major city provides a built-in audience for a lot of foreign films. That audience does not exist in any substantial way in Philadelphia. So someone like Godard, for example, would never be big in Philadelphia. Truffaut would be big. Fellini would be big. Bergman would be big. But it's the major names. Can't really show films by minor directors unless an individual film just happens to be something that gets a lot of attention and draw much of an audience.
Do you go to the commercial cinemas much? To the new first release cinemas?
Less and less every year.
You know, a lot of people are so disturbed about new trends in violence and sexual abuse. I wonder how you feel about that. You know, as someone who's been screening the Pink Flamingos and the Rocky Horror Show.
Well, Pink Flamingos and the Rocky Horror Picture Show are not taking the subject seriously. You know, first of all, Rocky Horror is not violent. I mean, there's one violent scene in the entire film.
No, but I could see people going in and saying, oh gosh, the 13-year-olds of the city are watching transsexual vampires or whatever, you know, transsexual beasts.
All I can say is you ought to have a social discussion with 13-year-olds.
When I was there, I really wanted to. I didn't, of course. I felt a little bit like a sociologist there that night. But I was really wondering, like, how... what the 13-year-olds understood about transsexuality or about...
A great deal.
Really. And also, I should say, one of the things that really got me thinking about that is that a few of the kids who were in the performance seemed pretty young, maybe 15 or 16, and were dressed up in, like, you know, black stockings and garter belts, very, S&M kind of attire, really.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, well, gee, what do they know about this? Are they being ironic about it, like the movie's being ironic? I really couldn't tell what was happening.
Well, some of them are being ironic, but truthfully, some of them are being quite serious. There is a big difference between young people today and young people 10 or more years ago. There are always changes. The current generation is not the first one to think that it discovered sex at the age of puberty. That's something that we've all gone through, and we all think we're breaking new ground, which we aren't. But there is a greater awareness of sexuality, of sexual innuendo, of sexual relationships among kids today who are puberty, pre-puberty even, or slightly older than I remember ever before.
One of the things I thought was kind of funny was watching people who had probably just gone through puberty having this very world-weary attitude expressed on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ironic. It's ironic.
It's funny. I almost think that I should just backtrack a little bit. I know some people will misunderstand what I said about 3 minutes ago when I used when I was talking about transsexuals and transsexual vampire. I can't remember what.
Well, you were talking about new trends in film.
No. I just want to say that I wasn't meant as a slur. I was just referring to the films and kind of the really odd way that everybody's treated within the movie. So do you have any feelings about the trends in first releases now? Are you disturbed about violence?
No.
Do you treat it with a certain amount of distance and irony, even if the film doesn't?
That's how I would put it. I have seen too many trends come and go. And there has been a trend in the last few years, very violence-oriented, very, very shock, horror-oriented. Whether it's from kung fu to exorcism, they're pretty predictable. The characters and the plots are pretty much interchangeable, and they're all cashing in on a wave of popularity. That's what people are going out to downtown theaters to see, and that's what's being made. And it shouldn't be surprising. I think it'll pass on. I don't know what will replace it. But it's not the sort of thing that's going to endure anyway. The individual films won't endure. There's almost nothing in the genres that we're talking about that have become very popular in the last few years.
You know what I can think of? The Sergio Leone series, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More. Those were, pretty violent, sadistic types of westerns, but they're always coming back at the repertory cinemas, and some people view them, very seriously as a kind of special example of that type of genre.
Well, I take Leone pretty seriously. I don't take him as seriously as I take Godard or Truffaut or Fellini, but I take Leone seriously. Once Upon a Time in the West is really a very well put together film, very interesting.
So you think chances are that in the genres that a lot of people are basically writing off now as being a really horrible flash in the pan, that there will be people working within those genres whose work will endure for one reason or another?
Well, the only person that I can think, there are a couple of people who are being discussed seriously in film magazines, for example, Brian De Palma, John Carpenter. Whether or not their work will endure, I don't want to speculate. I think that it's always very difficult at the time that something is going on to gauge how it will be viewed some years hence. Mm-hmm. You never know. But De Palma has elicited a lot of interest for quite a number of years now.
I consider him to be outside of that genre.
He's cashing in on it.
They're not fast, cheap films.
That's true,
like,
but because of the genre and because of its popularity, Brian De Palma is able to go out and make his films. He doesn't have to run a lot of roadblocks in order to get his projects on screen. So it's, I suppose in that sense, life is very convenient for Brian De Palma. There are probably, for every Brian De Palma, there's probably 100 or 1,000 directors who have projects that don't fit into what is commercially desirable these days, who have to run roadblocks for years to get one film launched, and De Palma can go out and just knock one out every year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate, not because De Palma's getting to make films, because other people aren't.
Well, time's gone very quickly, and we're really just about out of time, but tell us what's happening in the next few weeks at the TLA, some of the special things you have planned.
We've just concluded a tribute to Peter Sellers. We have coming up a variety of repertory films. We've got children's films on Saturday afternoons, and we've got a cultural series on Sunday afternoons, in which we're going to be showing Joseph Losey's Don Giovanni, his Mozart film. We'll be showing Irina Papas in Iphigenia. We'll be showing Chagall. We also have a gay film festival coming up that will run for about 9 days. That comes up next week. And then beginning on November 10th, we have a Fassbinder Festival, which is the first major Fassbinder festival that's been done in Philadelphia. We have 10 of his films. He Fassbinder is one of the most prominent of the new German filmmakers.
One of the most prolific.
And he is the most prolific director working in the world today. He had made 30 films by the time he was 30. He's slowed down a little bit now. He only makes one every year or two. But we have 10 films. They cover a period of about 10 or so years in his career. They're all typically Fassbinder, but they differ from each other in very significant ways. And I think it's going to be a really interesting, exciting festival. We had a Herzog Fest. We had to show the films of Werner Herzog back in the spring, and it was an extremely popular festival. And many people who came to every single program in the series, and we're hoping that the same sort of interest and enthusiasm will exist for Fassbinder.
Well, Al, I want to thank you very much for being here. And I should mention, if anyone wants a more detailed rundown of the screenings, there are schedules available at the TLA, which is on South and 4th Streets. And I've been with Al Malmfeldt, who is the director of the TLA, and he's been running the cinema since it started in 1971. You may have been reading that the cinema was going to close and that a nightclub was going to open in its stead. And that was actually scheduled to happen at just about this time. Well, the closing of the TLA is no longer as imminent as it was. You may have heard that there was a coalition of people from the South Street area who were protesting the liquor license that was requested that would be needed in order to turn it into a club. There's also some litigation in process now. So everything remains to be seen. Things are kind of up in the air now, but the TLA continues, and your schedule runs until...
The current schedule runs until November 30th, and we are working on another one. If anyone would like a copy, they can call TLA, and we'll happily mail them one right away. And they can do that by calling 922-6011.
Great. Well, Al, thanks a lot for being here. It's been really interesting to talk with you.
Terry, thank you very much for having me back.
Al Malmfeldt is the director of the TLA. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.
Well, if this doesn't get them, nothing will.
Simple things, 'cause I'm awfully fond of getting love in a natural setting. This is what I call the simple things, just a winding stream where I can drift and dream. And now I'm waiting for you by a waterfall.
ceiling are blue. We'll spend our heavenly day here where the whispering waters play. There's a whippoorwill that's calling you. By a waterfall he's dreaming too. There's a magic melody Mother Nature sings to me. Beside a waterfall
for Busby Berkeley. We've been listening to most of By a Waterfall, one of Busby Berkeley's big and memorable production numbers. It's 2 minutes to 3 o'clock. Technology does that. What can you say? It's 2 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia. You don't have to go into a museum to see sculpture in Philadelphia. When you drive or walk through the city, you're bound to pass works of art such as Klaus Oldenburg's Clothespin or Robert Indiana's Love. Recently, some of Philadelphia's art schools have been trying to organize events around this outdoor art. Last spring, the Institute of Contemporary Art published a map of public art in Philadelphia as part of its Urban Encounter show. Well, this Sunday afternoon, the Philadelphia College of Art will be leading a sculpture jog to be led by PCA's president, Thomas Shute, with commentary by art critic and teacher Patricia Stewart. Now, Pat is with me now to talk with us about some of the sculpture that many of us pass every day or each week on the way to work or shopping or on your way home. Pat is on the faculty of the Philadelphia College of Art and Moore College of Art. She is a former curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. She was also a contributing editor to the Arts Exchange magazine. Pat, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We seem to really have, I think, more than the average city does in terms of outdoor sculpture.
We have a lot. I've never done a body count from city to city, but the history of American sculpture is very much connected with Philadelphia. Most public sculpture was done after 1876, and of course 1876 was the big centennial exhibition in Philadelphia. Memorial Hall, still there, was built to house an exhibit of sculpture, and American sculptors sent their pieces in hopes of attracting commissions after this big show, and many of them did. For example, The Minuteman, it's a piece in Concord, Massachusetts, by an artist named French, was first seen by people from Concord in the Philadelphia exhibit, and after seeing it there, they gave him the commission to actually do the piece in bronze, lending him things like their grandparents' uniforms so that he'd be sure to get the costume right.
Do you think people relate differently to outdoor sculpture than to the art that you have to enter into a museum to go and see?
I think so. Very often people forget it's there, don't notice it or think about it, which is why we're doing this tour. But it is very much part of people's lives. When Klaus Oldenburg put up the clothespin, for the example, the press just had a wonderful time with it. I mean, you got comments like, oh, it's a clothespin opposite City Hall. That's so they can hang out the dirty linen. It provokes a kind of width or spectrum of responses that you don't get from stuff that's living alone in purity and isolation in a museum.
Would you have any favorites in the outdoor art?
My real favorite is one that not too many people know because it's up way up in West Philadelphia in Clark Park, 47th in Baltimore. It's a sculpture of Dickens and Little Nell. And I think I like it because of the literary kind of associations. For one thing, people read, when that piece was done, people were reading Charles Dickens the way they watch Dallas now. Everybody read it. And when the last installment of the Dickens book, The Old Curiosity Shop, came into New York Harbor on the steamer, there were a crowd of people standing on the dock calling, "Is Little Nell dead yet? Is Little Nell dead yet?" And that piece is of Dickens and Little Nell, the heroine of that book. And to make things even more kind of entertaining and literary, the sculptor who did that piece was taught how to sculpt by Amy. Do you remember Amy and Little Women?
Oh, yeah.
She was taught how to sculpt, his name was Frank Elwell, by the younger sister of Louisa May Alcott, the woman who was the original of Amy in the book. So I like the piece for all of those sentimental and bookish sorts of associations.
That is one of the lesser known.
Yes, it's not terribly well known.
One of the better known ones is Robert Indiana's Love Sculpture, mm-hmm. L-O-V-E. Mm-hmm. Do you take that sculpture ironically? How do you perceive it?
I take it a little ironically, I think, just because it has so little real connection with the city. I mean, the city kind of borrowed it, and then people decided they liked it, and it was purchased and given to the city. But it was a piece based on a piece Indiana had done years ago. It wasn't really done for Philadelphia. But it's certainly very popular. Anytime you go through that park and pass the piece, you see people in front of it getting wedding pictures taken. It's a great place for taking wedding pictures in front of the love statue.
Do you think he meant it as an everything is beautiful, why don't we love each other kind of statement?
No, I think he meant it in an ironic sense. I mean, you have the love is such a personal, subjective thing, and there you've got it mass-produced in standardized letters.
Okay. Now, we have a family of Calders on display in different parts of Philadelphia.
Yes, so Philadelphia has many Calders. It's almost as bad as the Peels. It's very hard to tell them all apart, whole families of artists.
Which are your favorites of the Calders' work?
I think I like the Swan Fountain in Logan's Circle. I think, first of all, it's a beautiful fountain. And again, the history of it is fascinating. It was essentially paid for by the SPCA, you know. There used to be a fountain society in Philadelphia, which was connected with the SPCA, and they put up fountains for the benefit of the poor, tired horses. And that piece was one of the fountains put up by that society.
I remember, it's near where we are now here at WUHI, but when the sculpture was commissioned for in front of the roundhouse.
The policeman and the child.
Yeah. What can you tell us about that?
I don't know that much about the history of that piece. It's, again, when you get into sculpture, you get into a wonderful situation where you have this whole sort of symphony of human motives. I mean, it isn't just what the artist feels like doing, it's what somebody feels like paying for. Sculpture's so expensive, you know, it costs thousands and thousands of dollars to do a bronze figure. No artist working alone in kind of purity in the studio can hope to manage that, so the artist has to get out there and, you know, wangle with the commissioning agents and fight with the architects and the city planners, and you get everybody's finger in the pie.
There's many ways in which the population of a city could be divided. Sometimes I think one way is in terms of the people who want to see representational sculpture outside, mm-hmm. and the people who want to see more abstract sculpture mm-hmm. outside.
Yes, you get these real kind of battle situations. So there was a piece done in Hartford a few years ago by Carl Andre, which became a major election issue. And people in the city didn't like the piece. It's rather severe, and complained that the city government had spent money on it, and there had not been a cent of city money spent on the piece. It was federal money and money raised by privately by people who lived in the city. But nobody seemed to want to listen to the facts. It became an election issue, and I remember somebody in Hartford saying at the time, you know, it's as if you were for this piece, you were against motherhood. You get a want again this confusion of motives.
But whose taste do you think public sculpture should represent?
I don't think any. Well, who should? I myself am interested in it because it isn't one person's taste. Because you can see a piece of public sculpture as having resulted from argument or cooperation between many different people and many different needs.
Sometimes I wonder. Like if a building is going to be collapsing or being torn down and something else will be replacing it, and if a sculpture was done specifically for mm-hmm. the outside of that building, mm-hmm. what's going to happen to the sculpture, like, say, in 100 years?
Very often very odd, orphaned sort of history. You know those eagles on the bridge that crosses the Schuylkill at Market Street? They were originally done for Old Penn Station in New York, and the building came down, and they were looking for a home for the sculpture, and the art museum in Philadelphia spoke up and brought them down here and had them put up there. Sculpture is always very much part of a context of a particular situation.
Well, you'll be jogging and walking and leading people, doing all kinds of things around Central City mm-hmm. Sculpture on Sunday. Tell us a little bit about what's planned for Sunday.
Well, we're going to start at 2 o'clock at the college, and led by the president, we are going to go up Broad Street to look at and talk about Billy Penn, you know, the Calder piece on top of City Hall, which is, I guess, the single best-known piece of sculpture in the city. It turns up in three-quarters of the postcards you buy in a railroad station in Philadelphia. So we'll talk about that, and then we'll talk about the clothespin as an example of something more modern, and we'll talk about a piece in front of the cathedral on Logan Circle, which was done by a sculptor who's on the PCA faculty, Walter Earl Bach. It's a piece, it's called Christ Breaking Bread, and it's in some respects it's a very researched piece. Christ is holding out what looks like a loaf of pita bread, and this is, of course, historical accuracy on Walter's part, because it was unleavened bread, which would have been like pita bread. And then we're going to talk about the Logan Square Fountain, the other Calder piece. And, of course, there are a lot of other pieces you kind of take in as you go that route, so if people are interested in stopping at them, we can do that.
And you'll be giving commentary mm-hmm. as... Everyone stops by each sculpture.
Yes, I'll be kind of the tour guide.
Yeah. Okay. So this is coming up on Sunday. That's this mm-hmm. Sunday afternoon. And everyone's meeting at 2 o'clock in front of the Philadelphia College of Art on Broad and Pine Streets.
Yes. And well, Broad and Spruce,
Broad and
actually,
Spruce Streets.
The new building.
Okay. And of course, it's everyone's invited, and of course, there's no charge or anything.
No charge.
And you don't have to run. You can walk if you want
to. You can walk, stroll. With that, we may even have a fair amount of trolley. To take along those who don't particularly feel like walking.
Okay.
We're being very accommodating.
Well, Pat, thanks very much for speaking with us about the jog and about some of the Center City sculpture.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Pat Stewart, who's on the faculty of the Philadelphia College of Art and on the faculty of the Moore College of Art, and she'll be providing this commentary for the sculpture jog on Sunday. Well, maybe you're actually getting into your car and heading off for New England or for warmer climates down south or wherever this weekend. In just a couple of minutes on Fresh Air, we'll be hearing an interview about road food, how you can figure out when you're driving where you can stop to get some good regional food. So that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. It's 9 minutes after 3. This is Billie Holiday.
Under
That was Billie Holiday. It's 12 minutes after 3 on Fresh Air, WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Well, what she was singing may be true. Things may be wonderful and terrific in your own backyard. But on the other hand, a lot of people really want to get out and travel before winter sets in and it gets really cold and the snows make the roads difficult to drive on. I know a lot of people also follow the leaves and start heading towards New England at about this time, where it's really beautiful when the leaves are turning color. Well, if you plan on driving any distances in your car, you might be interested in what Jane and Michael Stern have to say. They have rewritten their guidebook, Road Food, which is a guide to inexpensive regional restaurants around the country, all within 10 miles of a highway. You know what it's like when you're on a road and you're hungry and you don't want a boiled hamburger or some other horrible food atrocity. You want something good and tasty and cheap. Well, they've tried to figure out ways of finding these restaurants and have made a guide to them. They've collaborated on some other books as well, books like Auto Ads and Amazing America, and a book called Trucker, A Portrait of the Last American Cowboy. Well, when I spoke with Jen and Michael Stern, I asked them how they developed a passion for road food.
Well, I think because my mother was such a terrible cook that she always took us out to restaurants, and I got used to eating in them. And really, the road food part of that came about when we finished the Trucker book. And Michael and I did this book partially together, and the part we did together where we were in the car, we had heard the myth, if you want a good meal, follow the truckers. And I guess came to find out that wasn't true.
In fact, while we were doing the Trucker book, it got to be just one of the things we hated most about doing the book. I mean, the one thing that we really did hate was eating, simply because we were eating in truck stops meal after meal, and it got to the point where we just couldn't stand it anymore, and we really just said, this is it, we're putting our feet down, we're going to interview the truckers, we're going to go with them, we're going to talk with them in the truck stops, but when it comes time to eating, we're going to get off the highway and see if we can find a decent meal. And so long before we ever had the idea to do the book Road Food, we found ourselves looking for it, even before we even knew that name.
You're undermining a great American myth, and that's the myth of the truck stop. What's wrong with truck stops?
Well, I think they used to be really good, but now the reason truckers eat in them is because there's no place else they can park that 18-wheel rig. A lot of little great cafes don't have the parking facilities, so the truckers are sort of prisoners of the highway. And they go in there looking for a good meal, and what they get is a microwave oven type thing for exorbitant prices. And the really good food is maybe on what are now secondary highways where the truckers used to go, the little ma and pa cafes that the truckers can't get to anymore, but we can.
Do you think that that's changed? You know, that the bad food at truck stops and the expensive prices is something recent?
Definitely. I think it's definitely a product of the fact that they're all franchised and the fact that basically the truck stops have a captive audience. Truckers and tourists, you know, driving along the highway basically don't want to wander around off the highway for 15, 20 minutes or a half hour, maybe finding good food, but maybe not. So they say, you know, what the hell, let's go to the truck stop and eat there. At least we won't get killed, you know, or poisoned or something.
Well, that's interesting because the last time I stopped at a truck stop, I thought I was going to get killed. it was in Connecticut in a small little town, and it said truck stop. So I nudged my friend and I said, hey, these truck stops, they're the great places to stop in. Why don't we go in here and get something to eat? And it should have been called bike stop, because everyone in it was actually not a truck driver, but rather a biker.
Uh-oh.
And there were a lot of very tough-looking people who thought that we were invaders from Mars. And we got out of there real quick. Very, very hostile vibrations being directed towards us there.
Well, you know, that's funny. There's a trucker myth. I guess it's sort of an apocryphal story about, and it was actually made into a song not too long ago, about the trucker who goes into the diner and there's a bunch of bikers there. Remember? And the bikers hassle him and the trucker just sits there and takes it, but when he leaves the diner, he backs up over in all their Harley Davidsons and crushes them. And when I first heard the story, I thought, oh, well, this must be true. Then I heard it from about 67 truckers and realized it was definitely a myth.
All of them knew the guy that did it.
Right.
Oh, that's great. I never heard the song. When you're on the road, since you don't want to eat at the truck stops, how do you take your chances? Because I just really have no system at all for figuring out which exit to get off at. And then if it says food and there's arrows pointing in each direction, I just stop there and I can't figure out if I should turn
exactly.
right or turn
well, it's
left.
Really, if you're traveling and looking for a good meal, it's really potluck. And we spend an awful lot of time making mistakes while we were writing Road Food. You know, there are 450 restaurants in the book. There are probably 4,000 that aren't in the book that we looked at, walked in, maybe even ordered a meal, or maybe even ate half a meal, and then decided, no way. But what we did anyway while we were researching Road Food was to really just stay off the highways and take the routes that ran parallel to the highways or nearby them and tried to go through the small towns. I mean, the old truck stops, many of those have gone out of business, and we found really the best bet for locating good food was to go to a small town and look for a cafe, a tea
and you,
room.
You do develop radar after a while. I mean, we would, if let's say a place had an old rodeo poster in the window, or the sheriff's car was there, or they had a big round table in the front window with all the local guys in overalls sitting there, you kind of said, well, if the locals eat here, it's got to be good. On the other hand, if the thing has a giant billboard on the highway and says home cooking, you know, or
bus
something,
is
you
can,
bus is welcome, right, you know to avoid it. You also never ask the clerk at the hotel where to eat, because he sends you to the spinning thing on top of the tallest building in town.
One of the other things we found is that when we first started really thinking about doing Road Food, we would pull into small towns and say, where's there a good restaurant? And we would always get sent to the most expensive, you know, L'Escargot or something in a small town. And that's usually really awful.
It's the spinner.
The one that spins. So what we started to do when we did ask people was to ask them, where do you eat if you don't want a fancy meal? And then we started finding ourselves clued into Road Food. I remember sometimes in the morning when we were looking for breakfast, I mean, this sounds silly, but we would just roll the windows down and drive through a town, you know, and try and smell where the biscuits were coming from, and occasionally found some good ones.
Oh, gosh. Well, you've told us some clues as to evidences of it being a good restaurant. What are some of the things that you see when you drive by and you know this is not the place for you?
A lot of motorcycles parked outside.
Right, or a lot of Winnebagos or a lot of Greyhound buses, anything that looks like it's for tourists only.
One other thing we did find that's generally true about Road Food, except in Louisiana, is that places that serve liquor or that specialize in serving liquor are generally not going to have good regional food. Except, I mean, for expensive restaurants, of course, that's not true, but for inexpensive Road Food restaurants, we found that I think we maybe have 2 or 3 taverns in the whole book. And other than that, we looked for places that looked like family places, that looked friendly, that weren't cinder block bunkers
with
beer
signs.
But nothing
that bills itself as a family restaurant.
No, that's
because
dangerous.
That usually means it's terrible also. It means it's fast food often.
This is the second edition of your book, Road Food, and the first one came out how many years ago?
78?
2 years ago,
Two years ago, yeah.
Have you kept in touch with any of the people whose restaurants you mentioned in the first book? And have they changed at all? Have a lot of people come, and has that changed the nature of the
restaurant? Well, the ones that changed too much, at least changed and were no longer road food, got dumped for this edition. That was their penalty for getting too famous. The ones that we kept in there are the ones that just sort of took their newfound fame with a noblesse oblige, sort of, that they were just going to keep doing the same old down-home cooking no matter what happened to them. And fortunately, that was the case. In most cases, that was
true. Well, you know, when we began doing road food, We sat down and talked with each other, and we said, well, now, should we announce ourselves when we go into the restaurant? Should we say we're doing a guidebook to great regional food? And we debated about it one way or the other, and we finally decided we wouldn't, at least until after we sampled the meal. And I would say of the 450 places in the book, maybe 10 or 15 had any sense of what we were doing when we told them what we were doing, since most of them are so kind of regionally, locally oriented.
You could have been Craig Claiborne and come in, and they really wouldn't have cared. I remember when we started off, we had a long talk about should we or shouldn't we take bribes.
Or
free meals or anything. And I mean, the only thing we were ever offered was a pack of Trident gum from some diner in New Jersey. It just said, here, would you like, you know, have a pack of gum. So we took it. But with the type of food that we write about, it's not like they're going to, like, pay, you know, slip you $100 under the table to get in the book.
The other thing is, unlike, say, a food critic who writes about a small, undiscovered city restaurant, and then the restaurant just becomes jammed with people who want to go there. You know, since the road food restaurants are spread out all across the country, in no cases did, at least none that I know about, were any of these places spoiled by whatever fame they got from the book. There are a few people who did tell us that their business has increased, but, I mean, we were pretty happy about that. But no place had to, you know, add on a huge dining room to handle the road food clientele.
Didn't Mrs. Ford's coffee shop in Laurinburg, North Carolina, which when we were there you could get a 5-course meal for 75 cents, is now charging 85 cents. So that's about as.
But she blamed that on inflation,
right? Not on fame.
Okay, what are some of the great regional dishes that you tasted on some of your tours on the road?
Oh boy, burgoo is really a wonderful dish. That is from Kentucky.
What is that?
Burgoo is really, it's like a stew that has,
well, traditionally,
it's like a gumbo almost.
It's a kind of gumbo made in northwestern Kentucky, a very small part of the state, and southern Illinois as well. And traditionally, it's a game stew with squirrel, possum, all kinds of things like that. The way they make it now at the Shady Rest restaurant, I believe it's made with ham, beef,
mutton. Then there's funeral pie from Pennsylvania, which is a Pennsylvania Dutch dish, which is a raisin pie. And it used to be stored in pie safes and in cellars before refrigeration. It's a pie. It's like a mince pie. Are you familiar with it? Have you ever tried
funeral
it?
Pie? No,
yeah.
I haven't.
And it was really the fancy pie that was kept down in a cool cellar until somebody died and then brought out for the funeral because it was, you know, it would keep and it was the fancy thing to eat.
And as long as we're speaking about necrological food, we may as well talk about graveyard stew, which is something you find in the Dakotas, which actually isn't as bad as it sounds. That's the local name for milk toast, so named because it is eaten by people with one foot in the grave.
And then there's Fanny Daddies.
What's
which,
that?
Is the one of the New England nicknames for fried clams. And there's Fasnacht, which is a Pennsylvania Dutch. What is it?
It's a
raised donut, isn't it? And I'm trying to think.
Well, of course, in Louisiana, I mean, that's one of the great road food states. We had wonderful Cajun dishes like turtle piquant and, of course, gumbo and catfish.
Peaky bread? Do you know peaky bread?
No.
Peaky bread is one of the weirdest looking things. We first saw it at the Hopi Indian Reservation, which has a restaurant right on the premises, which is really one of the few places you can eat Hopi food. And the bread is made from blue corn, blue maize, and it's ground up and it's fried on a hot stone that has been coated with fat from sheep's brains. This sounds so disgusting, but it doesn't taste as horrible as my description. And it looks like blue strudel. It is the lightest thing, and it's made in the most primitive conditions. And you can get that and Hopi hominy stew as a meal for, I think, $2 or something, and it's really interesting food.
If you go to a place in the Pennsylvania Dutch area and order funeral pie, do you have to have a funeral to go to?
Or can
you
just not.
No, no. Actually, the place that we found it was a place called Dorothea's Fort Lowther Restaurant in Carlisle, and she
where
serves
they have the Fasnacht,
I think, almost
too.
Every day, yeah.
Do you play jukeboxes when you're on the road?
Oh, yeah, sure.
To go with the food, you know.
Right.
It's part of the ambiance.
Music to eat with, yeah.
Were there any outstanding jukeboxes that you came across?
Well, I think my favorite jukebox was at a place called Pete's Pit in Michigan City, Indiana, which is a rib joint. And, it's a 4-star rib joint, for starters. It's a little dump by the side of the road with fabulous ribs and sweet potato pie and buffalo fish and a really funky soul food. And they have a pristine Motown jukebox, like from, let's say, 1968, where nothing has changed since 1968. And you've got your Martha and the Vandellas, you know, just blasting out Nowhere to Run. And you're, you know, sort of in the shadow of Detroit eating ribs and listening to Motown. And it's just a primal Motown experience, I think.
A little bit more restrained would be the jukebox at Shirley's Diner in Fickle, Indiana, where we were just kind of looking through the jukebox, and we were amazed to see that they had, among the tunes that they had on the jukebox were Happy Birthday, the Anniversary Waltz, I can't remember, like all kinds of wedding tunes. Apparently this was the place that the townspeople went after almost any celebration, and the jukebox provided them with a substitute for a band.
Oh, that's wonderful. Remember that place, Michael, had the fattest waitresses that we've ever seen? I should talk. I know people on the radio can't see us, but people always look at me and say, well, she must do all the eating and he must do all the riding. I mean, after road food, I think I put on 30 pounds. But this one particular diner in Indiana, I don't think any waitress weighed under 300 pounds, and it was really a good advertisement for their food, which was delicious.
Did you ever think that in places where the waitresses are older, that it's a place that's probably been around for a long time, where people have grown with the restaurant and working
for years?
Well, you
know, old people are getting back to your earlier question of what a good sign of road food would be. Old people are often a sign of excellent cooking because they really are interested in the old ways of cooking and they have the time and the patience. As a matter of fact, one of our favorite restaurants is in Clarendon, Texas. It's a place called Mrs. Bromley's Dining Room, and it's actually in Mrs. Bromley's house, and she's a woman who must be in her upper 70s, and you come into her house, and she has a smorgasbord set out for you. 6 kinds of homemade biscuits, 7 pies, big ham, big turkey, and at the end of the meal, she came up to us, and she said, you know, I see you've been sitting here eating for 2 hours. You look very tired. Why don't you go up, take a nap in my bedroom, and then when you're refreshed, come down and eat some more. So it's kind of a really nice way to go.
So how many times did your car break down when you were riding road food?
Only one. It really broke down in that.
Washington, Pennsylvania, home of the Cozy Cottage. We actually, because our car broke down, we found a very good meal. I can't even remember what the meal was. It was a kind of...
I remember it ended with peanut butter pie.
Peanut butter pie,
terrific.
That's right. And we probably would never have stopped there had our engine just...
Yeah, the car knew more than we did.
What kind of car do you have? Or did you have?
Well, we had a Volkswagen Rabbit, and it was absolutely horrible, and we swore we'd never get another one, and we just went out 2 weeks ago and bought a Volkswagen Rabbit, which says something about our...
But we've been through a lot of cars in between that. We've put several hundred thousand miles on our cars doing road food.
Do you worry? Well, I guess Volkswagens are easy to find parts for, but when you know you're going to be on the road a lot, you always try to find a car where if you break down any place, you can find a car.
Yeah, we were thinking of that, but I have a bad back, and since I can't afford, I had to get a German car, and I can't afford a Mercedes, so the Volkswagen was the only one I could sit in comfortably.
You know, actually, when we started out to do road food, this is typical Stern methodology.
Oh, yes.
We got our advance from the publisher, and we bought, I think it was, like a $13,000 GMC motorhome thing to drive around, and thinking, well, this is a great way to save money. We will never have to stay in a motel. So instead, we spend thousands of dollars on this dumb thing. We camped out one night in it and hated it so much. We were so uncomfortable that we swore we would never do it again. That afternoon, we were in North Carolina, and we were back-ended by a fully loaded cement truck, which just accordioned the car, also spilling Michael's collection of barbecue sauces that he had been collecting through the whole route.
It was really a gory-looking accident.
And we were fine. We weren't hurt in the slightest, but ambulances came from every little burg around because they saw just, you know, a mile of barbecue sauce.
And they couldn't understand why I was so unhappy, why I was more unhappy about the barbecue sauce in the car.
Right, you know, because we hated the car.
You were able to get insurance on that and buy what you really wanted.
It was just totaled, which was
Did you get sick and tired of staying in motels?
That was the worst thing about doing road food. You know, it was we would almost never get sick of finding really good food. I mean, occasionally we wouldn't find any, and that was sort of depressing when we couldn't get a good meal. But it was the staying in motels night after night that made us come back after, say, 2 or 3 months, because that is what is really grueling.
What do you hate about that?
The sameness. The anonymity.
Yeah, there's something very depressing about the ritual of pulling into the motel, opening the door. There's the shag rug. Okay, now what? Well, let's go to the motel dining room and we'll get our bottle of club soda. Where's the ice machine? You know, we sort of park ourselves for the night. Where's the TV listings? What's this weird channel? Trying to figure out what channels correspond to Connecticut channels and where our favorite shows are. And
after a couple of trips, we actually took some pictures, framed pictures of our dog and our friends, and would just, like, the minute we walked into the motel room, just take down their ugly art and just tape up pictures of our friends and our dog just so it had some semblance of our real life, you know.
Would you ever pick up hitchhikers?
We used to, but I think we heard too many scare stories about it, so we stopped. I always wondered if I had to hitchhike someplace, what I would do to try and make myself look non-psychotic or crazed or something.
I decided that might be impossible because, you know, if you've seen enough, like, O'Hara films, for instance, or even Hitchcock movies where everybody has a double-edged side about
mm-hmm.
them,
mm-hmm.
and they initially look like just an ordinary person, but if you look hard enough, you can always find something suspicious in someone
exactly.
you don't know.
Especially after that horrible guy on the West Coast who killed all those women.
Oh, the highway murderer.
That looks so straight. I mean, actually, I think if I had a choice, I'd rather pick up somebody who had shackles on or a striped
a shaved
suit
head.
Rather than a guy with a crew cut in a suit, because you figure there's got to be something really wrong with that guy with a suit on.
Did you used to hitchhike?
No, not really. Well, Jane did some hitchhiking of sorts when she did the Trucker book, but that was somewhat more formalized than just standing on the road with a thumb out. But
the last time I hitchhiked with a trucker, and I think actually if you had to choose between hitchhiking with a trucker and just any old car on the highway, I choose a trucker because, you know, he's not in his truck to rob banks usually. I mean, he's sort of a professional driver, and I'm sure he knows how to drive. But the last time I hitchhiked with a trucker, the guy was driving along, and it was really late at night, and we were having a very nice conversation, and he pointed to the road, and he said, look at that couch. And I said, what couch? And he said, that couch. And he kept pointing, and I thought, there's